Hi, you're tuned to Truth News Radio Australia on the 25th of October 2014. Welcome to the show, folks. My name's Hereward Fenton. I'll be with you for the next 2 hours, and we're going to be talking today about Ebola for most of the show. I've got a guest coming on in the second hour, John Rappaport, who is a writer, journalist, who has written extensively on matters of medical fraud in relation to AIDS and HIV. Now, his knowledge comes in very handy in relation to some questions about Ebola. The whole issue about the way Ebola is tested is something that has been hardly touched on by any investigators in either mainstream or alternative news. And it's actually a very important question to consider, because the Ebola tests that are being used to evaluate whether someone actually has the virus or not are extremely suspect and, according to John Rappaport, completely unreliable. And John Rappaport may be a journalist, but he bases his knowledge on that of experts, including the inventor of the technique itself, Carrie Mullis, who invented the polymerase chain reaction technique, which is now being used to test for Ebola. And why this is so important, folks, is because when we're told that an individual has Ebola, and that this is now proven with a test, well, we assume that that's fairly conclusive. We assume that it's done in a foolproof way, and that person must be full of viruses. I mean, they must be, their blood must be teeming with viruses. But the way in which the testing is being done indicates that is not the case at all. And we'll be getting into that in a lot more detail in the second hour. I want to talk about the way the media has crafted this crisis. And I know it sounds absurd to propose that we are being completely led up the garden path here. And I certainly don't want to present myself as any kind of expert on a medical level. I'm only analysing this from a sociological level and bringing knowledge that I have to the table. So please don't take anything I say as medical advice, and please don't consider that I know better than anyone who is or claims to be a medical expert. But I want us to consider a few things in today's show critically and clearly. And I want to try and steer away from all forms of paranoia and hysteria, including, my friends, including the paranoia which is being drummed up by the alternative media from people who are hyping the threat, or maybe suggesting that that this is an engineered bioweapon and fearing that there's much worse to come. And these fears are not ungrounded, but I think there's not enough evidence to indicate that any of that is real. Certainly the fear of it should be real. And, you know, just today we see in the news that that New York has now imposed mandatory quarantines on healthcare workers arriving from Africa. So in the US, at least, we do see measures being put in place to use the purported Ebola outbreak as a means of clamping down on personal freedoms. But I want to consider, firstly, let's just have a think about, you know, the whole world. Let's think about Africa, United States, Europe, Eastern Europe, Russia, vast areas of the world. We're not seeing much concern about Ebola coming from any other country other than the US and it's some of its satellite sort of ally countries. I mean, we have had the odd little scare in Australia, and there has been, you know, an odd little scare in Canada. But for the most part, the rest of the world doesn't seem to be concerned about Ebola. Now that's a little odd, isn't it? I mean, people are travelling from West Africa everywhere. I mean, they're not all targeting America. Why would they? People are travelling from point to point. They're travelling all over Africa. But we're seeing this incredible focus in the United States of the fear that Ebola is going to come into the United States. And it's just so out of proportion. It's so out of proportion to the reality. And it's so out of proportion to the rest of the world. And again, I just present this as a simple fact that I think is being largely ignored. Because, see, the media just continues with this frenzy. And obviously, they're being directed as to what they have to, as to their talking points. So the media is just being told to continually promote this fear and frenzy. And it's all focused on the United States. And it's curious, you know, the CDC is based in the United States. And the vaccine programs are all based in the United States. And of course, the responses are all coming from the United States, including the military response of putting troops on the ground in West Africa. So it's really, if you just sit back and look at it, it looks like, well, this is a vehicle for American hegemony, as well as potentially increasing tyranny within the United States itself. This is a vehicle. But of course, many people will accept unquestioningly the narrative about Ebola. But I want to actually question that narrative. But I don't want to do so in any kind of wild speculative way. I want to look at certain facts facts as that have been reported in the media that we have to consider facts. They may actually not even be true, but I have to start with factual reports. And what I want to focus on initially in today's show is the evidence that Ebola had spread once it was in the United States, the evidence that Ebola has spread. And I want to look specifically at the case of the two nurses, Nina Pham and Amber Vinson. Nina Pham actually today has been reported as being Ebola-free. Now, the question there in my mind is, okay, they've now reported that she's Ebola free. Was she ever even sick, ladies and gentlemen? This is a very, very important question that I want to consider, and I'll have a look at the latest reports as well in the next segment to follow up on that. But I have some reports from earlier last week, which are from mainstream news sources that really don't provide any evidence that she was ever sick. Nina Pham was the first nurse to allegedly come down with Ebola, and she was described as having a slightly elevated temperature at 99.5 degrees. Now, 99.5 degrees is actually only 1 degree Fahrenheit above normal. The human body has a range from normal of at least 1 degree. It's completely normal for your body's temperature to vary by 1 degree. And in women, it is even more common because during ovulation, every month, women's temperature goes up by about 1 degree. So there is absolutely nothing to be concerned about for a woman having a temperature of 99.5 degrees. However, this healthcare workers who are involved in Ebola have to take their temperature 3 or 4 times a day, right? So they're constantly monitoring their temperature, and any slight variation is going to be the object of great scrutiny, right? So Nina Pham reported a temperature of 99.5 degrees. That's all we know. That's all that's been reported. Now, I don't know if the next day she had a raging fever or not, because they didn't say. They didn't tell us. And they've now told us that she's clear of Ebola. That there's never been any report that she was ever actually ill, ladies and gentlemen. But she was tested. She was tested, yes. And we're going to be getting into that, the nature of that test, later on in the show. But what's far more important than the test results is whether or not she was sick. Now, the second nurse, Amber Vinson, also reported a temperature of 99.5 degrees, exactly the same temperature. And I mean exactly the same. This is as reported in a separate news story from the LA Times. The exact quote from the article. Before flying from Cleveland to Dallas on Monday, Vinson called the CDC to report an elevated temperature of 99.5 degrees Fahrenheit. She informed the agency that she was getting on a plane. Okay, the official body temperature threshold for suspected Ebola is currently set at 100.4 degrees Fahrenheit. Although it was previously set to 101.5 degrees. Now, the CDC lowered the threshold. We don't know why. They lowered it to 100.4 degrees. But in the wake of Amber Vinson and Nina Pham, there are calls for that threshold to be lowered even further. Now, if the threshold were lowered to 99.5 degrees Fahrenheit, probably half the population of the United States would be suspected of having Ebola. I mean, what better way to create mass hysteria than just lowering the temperature threshold so that there's just millions of people who might be ill? Now, again, let me emphasize that neither of these nurses is reported as showing any of the symptoms, the clear physiological symptoms of Ebola, which include things like vomiting, diarrhea, and bleeding. You're with Truth News Radio Australia, and today we are talking all about Ebola. I do hope you enjoy it. We'll be right back.
Men and women of Earth, may I have your attention? This is Herewood Fenton, host of Truth News Radio Australia. You're invited to join the info war as we work to restore truth in media and challenge the dark forces which now dominate mainstream news. I'm calling on you, valued listener, to use your hard-earned dollars to help us smash the globalist empire. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe today.
Welcome back, you're with Truth News Radio Australia. Okay, I'd like to play to you now a clip from Nina Pham speaking in a press conference on Friday. She was released from hospital on Friday the 24th of October, and she is now described as being completely cured. And indeed, she looks extremely well. We can see her in the video here speaking, and apparently she hugged President Obama. So here I'm going to play to you the video of Nina Pham speaking.
Good afternoon. I feel fortunate and blessed to be standing here today. I would first and foremost like to thank God, my family, and friends. Throughout this ordeal, I have put my trust in God and my medical team. I'm on my way back to recovery, even as I reflect on how many others have not been so fortunate. I believe in the power of prayer because I know so many people all over the world have been praying for me. I do not know how I can ever thank you, everyone, enough for their prayers and their expressions of concern, hope, and love. I join you in prayer now for the recovery of others, including my colleague and friend Amber Vinson and Dr. Craig Spencer. Although I no longer have Ebola, I know that it may be a while before I have my strength back. So with gratitude and respect for everyone's concern, I ask for my privacy and for my family's privacy to be respected as I return to Texas and try to get back to a normal life and reunite with my dog, Bentley.
Okay, I'll just leave it there. Now, look, what's interesting about this, folks, is that she was diagnosed with Ebola on the 8th of October. That's only a couple of weeks ago. That's exactly 2 weeks ago today. I mean, there's an incredibly rapid recovery from a deadly disease. I mean, on October the 17th, she was described as being ill with Ebola, although they didn't give any description of her symptoms. We never actually heard that she had vomiting, diarrhea, or bleeding, or any of these types of symptoms. But she was described in one article I've got here from CBS as simply being ill with Ebola, but clinically stable, is what they said. But the recovery is just staggering, isn't it? And I do have a source for that. I've got a timeline of Ebola in Dallas. It was announced on September the 29th that a man might have the deadly disease. On September the 30th, a medical test confirmed that Thomas Duncan had the Ebola virus. On October 12th, a Presbyterian healthcare worker who treated Duncan had tested positive for Ebola. Sorry, I said it was October 8. I'm wrong. It was October 12. Today being October 25, that is... that is just 13 days ago. Ladies and gentlemen, that's when she tested positive. I mean, that's a really, really, really rapid recovery. I mean, was she ever really sick? This is the point I want to put in your mind. Of course, she was treated as if she was sick. She reported as having a slightly elevated temperature. We know that. We know nothing about any other symptoms. And she looks terrific in the video that I'm watching here now. Ladies and gentlemen, the media and the government are engaged in giant propaganda PR campaigns. This is well known. This really happens. They use people like this. And you know what? They even justify it to themselves by saying, well, it's necessary because we've got to garner public opinion. We've got to mobilize, we've got to consolidate, and we need a figure for people to rally around, you know, one person who caught Ebola in the United States. They create all kinds of justifications for themselves as to why it's okay to spin a giant furphy. Now, you may say, of course, well, but she tested positive for the virus, and this is something that that I will now address, because the method by which Nina Pham and Amber Vinson and the doctor in New York have been tested as being positive for Ebola is extremely unreliable, extremely suspect, extremely problematic, folks. The test uses quantitative PCR, which stands for polymerase chain reaction. The technique's inventor, Carey Mullis, has been very, very critical of the misuse of his invention for testing for the HIV virus. The reason why the technique was used for testing for the HIV virus was because HIV could never be found in any measurable quantity in people suffering from AIDS. It simply couldn't be found in the blood. Carey Mullis doesn't believe his invention is capable of testing for HIV virus. Mullis says the problem is PCR is too efficient. It will amplify whatever DNA is in the sample, regardless of whether DNA belongs to HIV or a contaminant. And how do you decide which part of the amplified material could be HIV and which part the contaminants, if you couldn't detect HIV in the sample without using PCR? Now, let me just explain that further. The polymerase chain reaction is actually a type of it copies DNA sequences. It's a chemical reaction which causes DNA chains to be copied, and by tagging a certain sequence, you can amplify that sequence in any given sample. And so you can get significant quantities. And this has been very, very important in genetic research because it's part of what they do. It's a technique which is mainly used for research and genetic engineering. Turning it to be used for disease testing is a very, very unusual development, and it's only used in a very, very few number of disease cases. In the case of HIV, we know that HIV cannot be found in significant quantities in the blood. It just it won't be there, right? If the virus could be found in large quantities in the blood, you wouldn't need to test it. You wouldn't need to test it in this way. You could simply take a blood sample and find the virus. And normally if a person is very sick with a virus, well, the virus has to be there in large quantities because that's what's making them sick, right? Now, I'm going to read to you from a short interview here with Carey Mullis, if you can just bear with me. Actually, I'll tell you what, I'm going to play to you an interview with Carey Mullis talking about AIDS and the testing procedures. Now, this is relevant to Ebola, and you really just need to understand that Carey Mullis, Nobel Prize winner for discovering the technique of PCR, which is the principal method now being used to test for Ebola. We're just going to break shortly, but I'll continue with it after the break. Here we go.
California microbiologist Dr. Carey Mullis was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1993 for his development of one of the most widely used current techniques in molecular biology today, the PCR, or polymerase chain reaction. This revolutionary technique allows scientists to take a sample containing a very minute amount of DNA and replicate that DNA sequence until there are many copies.
Okay, we're just going to break. You're with Truth News Radio Australia talking about Ebola and HIV. Very interesting topic. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Thank you. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. And today's topic is Ebola, but I'm expanding here to talk a little about HIV and the PCR test, because this is central now to understanding Ebola and perhaps to understanding the way which we may be currently being misled about Ebola. And I'm playing to you here a clip from a documentary. I believe it's the Gary Null documentary about HIV, and it includes an interview here with Carrie Mullis talking about his invention and its misuse in relation to testing for HIV. So I'll just continue where we left off at the end of the last segment.
One of the first applications of PCR was to analyze human tissue for the presence of HIV. PCR is commonly used in medical and biological research labs for the detection of virus culture in infectious persons.
The people that are AIDS researchers now are getting neurotic if you ask them any questions. There was a time when I first started asking questions, that all I wanted was, where are the papers? Just tell me the papers that you read that convinced you that HIV was the cause of AIDS, because I need to reference those papers in some of the, I was working on a test for HIV with PCR, and I needed to write a little report to the NIH and say, here's the progress we've made. And the first line of it was, HIV is the probable cause of AIDS. And I thought that was true. This is before I got involved. And I said, what's the reference for that quote? And I looked for it for about 2 or 3 years, and I never could find it. And by the end of 2 years, I'd ask everybody at every meeting that I'd gone to that talked about AIDS, I'd ask, you know, I'd look through every computer database. There is no reference. There is nobody who should get credit for that statement. Now, that's a pretty weird situation in science, where getting credit for a discovery is the most important thing in your life as a scientist. It's silly to hear people saying, you don't believe that HIV causes AIDS? You don't believe that? I mean, it's just a word, but it's a very, very important distinction, I think, that you know, that's why it has become a very emotional kind of thing, because people actually, they get personally committed to what really is a body of evidence that can be analyzed, you know, by lots of people, and at this point, there's so much of it out there. Nobody can really analyze it, all of it, but nobody can write a review of it that says HIV causes AIDS because of this. You know, if a postdoc were to write a review of their literature that showed without much doubt that HIV was the cause of AIDS, that guy would be famous. Now, there's 100,000 guys out there who had the opportunity. It's 10 years has passed. We've been waiting for this star postdoctoral fellow to distinguish himself forever and get a lifelong grant from Tony Fauci, but he hasn't shown up. No one has bothered to write a definitive review. Any journal would take it. That right there proves that HIV does not cause AIDS. Just because Bob Gallo gets up, takes his sunglasses off and says, gentlemen, we discovered the cause of AIDS. That's all we have. New York Times article, CDC report, that's all we have. That's not enough.
Okay, I'll just leave it there. We don't really have time to play that whole segment. The important thing here to note is that Carrie Mullis invented the PCR technique. He was central to the development of the specific application of the PCR technique to testing for HIV. He tried to work out what the proof was that HIV actually causes AIDS and found out that there was none. He then became extremely critical of the CDC's use of his technique for testing for AIDS because, as he describes it, the test is not reliable. Now, I'm just going to read to you from an article here which actually describes some things about the PCR test in more detail. PCR takes advantage of certain fundamental properties of DNA. DNA is a nucleic acid, and nucleic acids are composed of nucleotide building blocks. DNA exists as two complementary strands arranged in a double helix formation. These strands are made up of many nucleotides hooked together to form a long chain of DNA. There are special rules about how bases form chemical bonds with other bases. An A will only bind to a T, a C will only bind to a G. A base on one strand binding to a base on another strand is called a complementary base pair. This rule of complementary base pairing is what gives DNA its ability to replicate itself exactly. Each time a cell divides, it has to make a copy of its DNA for the new cell. The DNA double strand first unzips itself into two separate strands. Each single strand serves as a template or pattern from which to make a new copy of its complementary strand. The single strand then incorporates new nucleotide building blocks from the surrounding medium according to the rule of complementary base pairing. The theory of HIV says it, like other suggested retroviruses, contains RNA but no DNA. When HIV is said to infect a cell, the reverse transcriptase enzyme is thought to transform the RNA into complementary DNA, which is then inserted into a host cell's DNA. Therefore, if PCR is used to analyze human tissue for the presence of HIV, it would be looking for only a short segment out of the entire cellular DNA strand. This short segment represents the genetic material proposed for HIV that, in theory, has been incorporated into the DNA of the cell. PCR works in the following fashion. Step 1. Heat the template. A long piece of DNA containing the smaller fragment to be copied is heated. The two strands can be melted apart at elevated temperatures and will slowly come back together upon cooling. This is also called annealing. The two separated strands are complementary to each other. They serve as templates for new strands. Step 2. Add the primers. Something called a primer is necessary for the next step. Primers are nucleotides that form a short sequence of a new strand. Primers are designed to be complementary to a known sequence, which is part of a larger sequence, and thus where the primers will bind or hybridize is known. So the primers are used to tag a sequence so that we can then replicate that specific sequence. The primers attach to each end of the DNA segment that is to be copied. The primers serve two purposes. A, to mark each end of the targeted segment, so only that segment will be amplified and not the entire strand. And B, to get the duplication process started. The new strands are built block by the action of an enzyme called polymerase. Using PCR to find HIV. A problem for the HIV hypothesis was that even with the use of standard PCR, researchers could not find much, if any, HIV in persons with AIDS diagnoses. To resolve this paradox, the authors of the new viral load papers came up with two modifications of PCR, which they claimed were much more efficient at finding HIV. These were the qC-PCR and the branched DNA test. And suddenly, billions of copies of what was believed to be HIV were found. The contradiction here seemed to have escaped the authors of these papers. Why would such powerful new tests be needed at all to find a microbe that is present in the billions? Okay, this is obviously very technical and detailed stuff, but I'm just going to jump to the central point here about the quantitative method of determining HIV. The idea is that you add to the sample to be estimated a known amount of similar but distinguishable DNA and amplify both together. The assumption is that the relative amounts of the two products should stay the same, and hence you should work out the size of the sample you started with by knowing the ratio of the two, determined by observation when PCR has produced enough of both to measure, and how much control DNA was added. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. We're going to break, talking about Ebola, HIV, and some very, very interesting little-known facts. We'll be right back after this short break. Hi, welcome back. You're with Truth News Radio Australia. Talking about the quantitative PCR technique used for measuring HIV, which is now also being used for testing for Ebola. And this is from an article on a site called virusmyth.com, which questions the validity of the HIV equals AIDS theory. What is absolutely critical is that the relative amounts of the test DNA and your known control must be exactly equal. This is referring to the specific method that is used to test for HIV. Close is not good enough. The slightest variations will be magnified exponentially and can produce massive errors in your estimate. The difficulties in using PCR quantitatively were pointed out by Luke Raymakers in the journal Analytical Biochemistry in 1993. He noted published papers on qPCR contain data that show that the fundamental assumption that the relative sizes of the samples remain constant is not met in practice. Despite this, HIV researchers continue to use PCR to quantify viral load. There is simply no way of knowing whether a given estimate is correct or is 100,000 times too high. Todd Miller calls the technique the latest fad in science and agrees that if the relative amounts of your test DNA and your known control are not equal, there is one thing you can say for sure about the estimate of your starting target: the amount of proposed HIV RNA in the patient blood sample. It will be wrong. So that I wanted to give you that as a detailed background for what we'll be talking about in hour two when John Rappaport comes on to consider some of these issues in more depth. Why is this method being used to test for Ebola? If people are sick with Ebola, their blood should be teeming with Ebola viruses. And indeed, if Nina Pham was sick with Ebola on the 17th of October, as reported by CBS, which is a week, just a week, friends, before she hugged President Obama, how is that possible? How could she recover that quickly? It blows my mind. I cannot make head or tail of this. I mean, let me know what you think. And if you want to criticize what I'm saying, please go ahead. But she tested positive for Ebola on the 12th of October, right? She was described as being sick with Ebola on the 17th of October. On the 24th of October, she hugs President Obama. I nearly said President Ebola there. There is something wrong here. There is something very, very wrong with the narrative. There is something very wrong with the way the subject of Ebola is just being used to define American society right now. I mean, it should be equally of a concern anywhere else in the world, any other country in Europe, in Russia, in China, in the whole of Asia. I assure you, there are many people from Africa traveling all around the world. And people from Africa travel a lot. Of course, some people may argue, well, no, they don't, and there's been all these strict border controls. Well, I think that's rubbish. I just don't think that border controls can ever be that strict. And why would people only fly from West Africa to the United States? It's all ridiculous, folks. It's just, when we have to sit back and look at the plain facts to understand how we've been deceived. Okay, another interesting fact to point out to you with the current Ebola outbreak, and this is from the CDC's fact sheet, is that unexplained bleeding, hemorrhaging, which we think of as being the hallmark of Ebola, has been present in only 18% of those allegedly suffering from Ebola. So it's less than one in five are suffering that key symptom that we all imagine is what Ebola is all about. Okay. Other symptoms such as headache, fever, nausea, vomiting, rashes, fatigue, these coincide with many, many different diseases, but there's two in particular that you need to pay attention to. They are malaria and dengue fever. Now, dengue fever, ladies and gentlemen, afflicts an estimated 100 million people around the world every year. Dengue fever is an absolutely rampant illness, which is justifiably, should be considered a very, very serious health problem. And we should be very worried about it. Because it's been going on for years and years and years, and so has malaria, killing millions every year. And again, the symptoms of malaria: fever, chills, headaches, sweats, fatigue, nausea, and vomiting. And in some cases, actually hemorrhaging as well. In extreme cases, there are certain forms of malaria that result in hemorrhaging. And many, many people die from malaria every year. I don't have the exact figures, but the numbers are staggeringly huge. So, one more thing to consider is that the only method we have for testing for Ebola is this PCR technique, which is a very sophisticated lab technique, which is not done at a cheap price. In fact, I guarantee you that it's not being used at all in Africa. It's being used in the United States. They can't afford to use it in Africa. There are too many people who are sick. It's not viable. In other words, they're simply eyeballing people and saying, Ebola, not Ebola, Ebola, not Ebola. But as we've seen, the one of the key symptoms of Ebola, which is bleeding, is not present in at least, I mean, it is only present in 18% of cases. So what is the diagnostic criteria by which they're deciding a patient is suffering from Ebola? I can tell you what the diagnostic criteria is. It's pressure from the World Health Organization, from the NIH, from the CDC, who are saying, we've got an epidemic here and we're going to send healthcare teams, we've got the boots on the ground, and you are going to find a whole lot of Ebola here. That's what they've said. And they've issued directives. They've said, if a person has a fever, if a person has a rash, they've got Ebola. The healthcare workers will have directives. And so suddenly we're seeing a terrible epidemic of Ebola, when in fact, epidemics are chronic in that part of the world. People are suffering terribly. They're suffering from malnutrition. They're suffering from terrible living conditions. They're suffering from poverty. Yes, it's bad. I'm certainly not trying to deny that people are sick, but people are sick for very, very many reasons. The creation of a scare like this serves geopolitical interests, which are so clear to me. So when we see the attention given to this, we have to look at it in the perspective of those hegemonic plans to control certain parts of the world, as well as the massive profit motive of those who are involved in treating this. This is what we can call disaster capitalism, folks. It's another form of disaster capitalism, the shock doctrine, as Naomi Klein described it. It's the exploiting of a natural disaster in order to make a whole heap of money. And in some cases, you might actually need to, as they say, you might need to dress it up a little so it looks a little worse than it is, so you can get the correct effect. I mean, this is what happened with the war on terror. This is what happened after the invasion of Iraq. It's the same type of deal. You know, you have to dress up the problem, and you create more of a disaster or create the perception of a disaster so that you can then mobilize and stimulate the economy that way, and a lot of people can make a lot of money. And, of course, the next phase of this is going to be the vaccine. The vaccine is currently being rushed into production, and the vaccine manufacturers are saying that the key obstacle now is they want indemnity. Oh, yeah, they want indemnity. They want to be protected because, as they say, we're being forced to do this in a hurry. We can't use the normal stringent methods of testing, so we want to be indemnified. Now, what that proves to you is that there is going to be a lot of people injured by this vaccine. Meanwhile, the endemic problems of people living in Africa go untreated. The lack of clean drinking water, the lack of decent food and accommodation, overcrowding. I mean, clean drinking water is probably the most important thing that would solve all of these chronic epidemics that occur in certain parts of Africa. Clean drinking water is so important, folks. Okay, we are at the end of the hour, ladies and gentlemen. It has been great talking to you, and I will be back in the second hour with my guest, Jean Rapoport. Very, very important hour coming up. And if you've got 5 minutes to spare, may I suggest you have a look at the website and go to the subscribe page. And if you like what we do on this show, become a subscriber. $65 a year Australian currency, and you get a free t-shirt. It's a pretty good investment of your money. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Jean Rapoport in the second hour. Don't go away.